You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, South Africa's deputy president is to challenge Jacob Zuma for the top job. We ask, just who is this man and does he stand a chance? Plus, we sent our very own Santiago Tarditi to Heathrow Airport to see Qatar Airways' first commercial 787 touchdown. He also caught up with their CEO.
It was important for us to come here with our brand new machine. It is the most luxurious aeroplane interior of its class, and it gives passengers a very good flying experience.
And expanding her empire, Paris Hilton chooses the holy city of Mecca for the site of her fifth store in Saudi Arabia. We got reaction from Riyadh coming up. And we ask, what's made this North Korean TV anchor so excited? Terrifying stuff. We'll also be talking through this year's Golden Globe nominations.
We have to remember that the Golden Globe nominations are not the AMPAS nominations. They're not Oscars. These are the foreign press voting in America. So it's a different slant.
And we'll also be checking in with Monocle's Paul Noble, who's busy setting up our Christmas broadcasts in St. Moritz. All that and lots more to come in the next hour, right here on Midori House. But before all that, let's get a wrap of the world news. That's with David Spencer.
Russia has acknowledged that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government may well be defeated by opposition forces. They say government forces are losing more and more territory. Meanwhile, NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has expressed concern about claims that Assad's regime has used Scud missiles.
The use of such indiscriminate weapons shows utter disregard for the lives of the Syrian people. It is reckless, and I strongly condemn it. The regime in Damascus is approaching collapse. I think now it's only a question of time.
Eurozone finance ministers are hailing agreement towards a banking union as a breakthrough. It means that the European Central Bank will become the zone's top banking supervisor of around 200 of the biggest banks. The agreement is being put before EU leaders. EU Economic and Monetary Affairs Commissioner Olli Rehn says the deal is a good move forward.
Last night's decision on the single supervisory mechanism for euro area banks is a breakthrough towards true banking union, which is significant and crucial in order to restore and reinforce confidence into the European economy.
Japan has accused China of violating its airspace for the first time after a Chinese government plane flew near disputed East China Sea islands. Fighter jets were scrambled after the plane was seen near one of the islands. Japan lodged an immediate protest with Beijing. The islands have been a source of tension for some time. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma is to face a challenge to his leadership of the ANC next week. Kgalema Motlanthe is currently President Zuma's deputy. Mr. Zuma has received most nominations, but critics say he's failed to tackle South Africa's problems. Meanwhile, ANC members have sent their good wishes to Nelson Mandela, who's recovering from a lung infection. Military veteran Mokobele Siko joined the delegation.
Fortunately, we have this morning heard that there's some improvement in his health. We hope that Tata Mandela will continue to be around for a while. He comes from a special generation of African National Congress leaders, but also a special generation of South Africans.
The International Air Transport Association has painted a positive picture for industry growth in 2013. Its annual review predicts a global recovery led by airlines in the United States, followed by an improvement in earnings for carriers in Asia, the Middle East and Latin America. However, the IATA says airlines in Europe will struggle to break even because of the Eurozone crisis. Its report also says 2012 is likely to be the safest year on record for its members, with one accident of any type every 5.3 million flights. That's the latest Monocle 24 news.
Thank you very much indeed, David. A very surprising set of figures to end on there.
It's almost worth repeating that statistic about safety. One accident of any type every 5.3 million flights.
That's not even 5.3 million passengers.
Exactly.
That's, multiply that by a couple of hundred and you've got the rate per passenger. Extraordinary.
We were trying to work that out, but our abacus sort of exploded at the mass that were involved in that. But also they predict that these figures, it's up until the end of November, obviously, but if this month is clear, it'll be the safest year on record, and also no incident involving Western Airlines of any type with fatalities, which is extraordinary.
Commendable for the industry. Thank you very much indeed, David. It's 6 minutes past six Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
Op London, du var Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, desde Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, today on Monocle 24, we've been talking about how South Africa is going to adjust to life after the currently infirm Nelson Mandela, and how, despite the African National Congress and their opposition to the Democratic Alliance's insistence that they carry his mantle on, his influence on the modern-day political circus is negligible. Here's Nathan Geffen, the editor of Ground Up.
Certainly his contribution has been absolutely immense, and in fact, it's actually quite hard to overestimate it, but the superhuman qualities that are endowed upon him in discourse and this absolute trepidation over the fact that he's one day going to die doesn't help. And it fuels the myth that when he dies, things will unravel, which is ridiculous. Whether or not South Africa thrives or whether our society unravels or whether we just continue to bumble along as we're doing at the moment, that's not dependent on Nelson Mandela staying alive or dying.
And that was Nathan Geffen speaking about the legacy of Nelson Mandela. Well, it's to the ANC's current leadership that we now turn. Kgalema Motlanthe, who is South Africa's deputy president, is to challenge Jacob Zuma for the top job. And if he wins, he will govern the party in control of Africa's largest economy. Well, to help us find out just who this man is and what his chances are, we're joined now on the line by our Cape Town correspondent, Alex Duval-Smith. Alex, what can you tell us about Mr. Motlanthe? We don't know a huge amount about him internationally.
He's done it well. In fact, it's a good point. I think not many South Africans know very much about him. He's the dark horse who is everything that Zuma isn't. He's not the populist. He has a bit of an intellectual profile. He's a former leader of the National Union of Mine Workers, which nominally places him on the left. Nominally, Zuma as well was placed on the left. But it would appear that Motlanthe, shall we say, has mellowed over the years. Motlanthe has actually already served as president. A lot of people forget this. In 2008, when the rather messy reign of Thabo Mbeki ended, it ended with Kgalema Motlanthe stepping in to the breach and serving as president for 4 or 5 months before Zuma took power as a result of the elections, which of course were won by the ANC. So he served already, and he serves regularly when Zuma's travelling. I mean, it's quite strong, quite good money on the idea that he really runs the country a lot of the time. A sort of sensible pair of hands. Diplomats like him. The international community likes him. He's considered someone you can do business with.
And you mentioned that Mr. Motlanthe's got the support of the miners. And of course, the miners in South Africa have been very much the front pages of the international press and television in recent months. Is that a key bastion of support for him?
Well, that's really what's very interesting, because the NUM, the National Union of Mine Workers, from which he comes, is indeed the largest union in COSATU, the Confederation of Southern African Trade Unions, who have strong voting powers. However, the NUM, in many people's eyes, and in many miners' eyes, has been discredited for becoming rather cosy, rather fond of sort of fast, high-off-the-ground cars. And many miners have left the NUM. So how representative the NUM is today, I mean, one hears figures of the NUM's membership plummeting to sort of 12% at, for example, Lonmin. And given that, you know, how representative is the NUM, but it does retain a huge amount of influence in Kossatu.
Is there a degree of surprise and shock about this decision for him to run against Mr. Zuma, not least perhaps from Mr. Zuma himself? Is he surprised?
Well, someone had to do it. Most of the analysts are saying Zuma will pull through. Zuma has managed, who's a great populist, has managed to secure the majority of branches who will vote at the elective conference next week. This is what is said and widely predicted. Is it a shock that he's running? I would say he was the only likely candidate, and he's the candidate of the sort of intellectuals, those who like to portray South Africa as being sensibly run, a modern and progressive society. But of course, Zuma is the populist. Zuma has a huge amount of support from ordinary people.
Yeah, just looking at some pictures of Mr. Motlanthe, he's a very smartly dressed individual, 63 years old, and as you say, he maintains something of a low profile. And you say that he's everything that Zuma is not. And of course, Zuma's presidency has had a couple of rather unpleasant and perhaps less palatable episodes in it, some allegations of corruption and a couple of other scandals as well. Tell us a little bit more.
Well, no. I mean, Zuma is the constant target, if you like, of revelations in the South African media, to the extent that he has been one to spearhead legislation to actually silence the media, legislation which is on the statute books and which is going to go through quite soon, the Secrecy of Information Act. But I would say that essentially, you know, the fact remains that there may have been several unpleasant episodes. Zuma is dragging skeletons behind him that include a rape trial from which he was cleared before he was elected president, a corruption scandal. Zuma allegedly received kickbacks from the sale 10 years ago by European arms manufacturers of arms to South Africa. There's been a recent scandal about him spending a large amount of taxpayers' money on his compound in KwaZulu-Natal. And these are all elements which remain in people's minds and which remain in the ANC leadership's, arsenal. Because the way the ANC works is that one can well imagine a situation where Zuma has been told, look, you won't lose face, you'll be re-elected at the elective conference because that's what you want, but we don't want you standing at the next election. And if you do stand at the next election, you'll actually be standing in a courtroom.
Well, there we have it. Galame Motlanthe to stand against President Zuma for the top job in South Africa. Thank you very much indeed for bringing us up to speed there. Alex Duval-Smith in Cape Town.
As 2012 draws to a close, Monocle has put together a selection of gifts that we'd like to find under the tree this year.
People of all ages turn to the teddy bear as the king of cuddly toys, and Shropshire's Merrythought is the firm to turn to. As the last remaining teddy manufacturer in the UK, its bears have become a sought-after collector's item. Opt for a classic Jackfield and an additional teddy bear picnic set, complete with a tartan blanket, miniature teacups and pots.
From portable coffee bean roasters to special edition parfum, you can find gift inspiration by watching our seasonal slideshow on monocle.com.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick-and-span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero-emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
A 6:15 in the evening, Greenwich Mean Time. You're listening to Midori House. Now, today, Heathrow International Airport was even busier than usual. And it wasn't just the Christmas holiday traveller traffic. The airport was crowded with a horde of photographers and journalists who were glued to the windows of Terminal 4, waiting with bated breath for Qatar Airways' first commercial 787 flight to touch down here in London. Well, the CEO of Qatar Airways, Akbar Al-Bakr, was amongst the passengers of the inaugural flight. And our very own Santiago Tarditi caught up with him inside the plane's cockpit to talk about the carrier's experience with Boeing's Dreamliner so far.
It was important for us to come here with our brand new machine, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. It is the most luxurious aeroplane interior of its class, and it gives passengers a very good flying experience.
Despite all the charm of the plane, it seems that you're disappointed with some technical difficulties that you've had with the plane. Can you explain what exactly these issues have been and how is Boeing tackling them?
Well, yes, we are disappointed because when we receive an aeroplane, we expect it to fly immediately. We have a third 787 Dreamliner that has been delivered to us. And from the time it has arrived, it is on the ground for the last 5 days. It has developed an electrical fault which needs a major replacement of major parts, and we eventually also had other issues with the Dreamliner. Keeping in mind that it is a brand new machine, we expect things like this to happen, but not with major components that happened with our aircraft number 3. And we really cannot with this new machine afford to have AOG situations which then adversely affects the passenger experience with Qatar Airways.
And how is this affecting the company itself and its growth? Well, and what are you doing to train your pilots?
Well, Qatar Airways, this kind of thing will not affect the company in the sense that we have another 116 aircraft. The only thing that it does is impedes our ability to generate more revenue in a difficult time.
Another milestone for the company is the partnership alliance with One World. How is this going to benefit Qatar?
Alliances is a two-way street. It will benefit Qatar Airways the same way it will also benefit others. The benefit to One World will be a huge market access into the Middle East. It will increase their market access into the Middle East to nearly 16% compared to only 5% they have today. It will also give them immediate access to 16 more destinations, which today they don't have without Qatar Airways. And Qatar Airways will have the ability to go to 850 destinations of the One World Alliance.
You will also be focusing on the A380, and one of Qatar's concerns seems to be the cabin layout. How are you going to deal with this, and will you be able to customize it?
Yes, we have already customized it. We have already frozen the design, and our first Airbus A380 will be delivered to us in the year 2014 January.
In 2013, are there going to be any new interesting destinations that you're looking forward to?
Yes, there will be another 13 to 14 new destinations in 2013.
Anyone in particular you're looking forward?
Well, we have already announced a major destination that will be Chicago.
How is competition in the luxury market affecting Qatar, and what is the company doing to differentiate itself from the other airlines?
Well, it is really competition does not affect Qatar Airways. We like competition because competition is making the airline stronger, better, and more high quality.
And that was the CEO of Qatar Airways, Akbar Al-Bakr. But his wasn't the only recognisable face there in the crowd at Heathrow. Santiago also spotted the CEO of Boeing, Sir Roger Bone, walking through the plane. And he asked him about Mr. Al-Bakr's comments there on some of the 787's technical difficulties.
Whenever you bring new products to the market, particularly the products with huge technological advances like the 787, there are bound to be issues, teething issues, and things that need to be sorted. Our responsibility as the manufacturer is to work as constructively as you can with the customer to ensure that these things are sorted. And that's exactly what we are doing and what we will continue to do.
How has this delayed the production and the delivery of the next 787s to Qatar Airways and the other airlines?
I can't answer that. I don't know to what extent it's delaying further deliveries to Qatar Airways. You must ask the Qatar Airways their views on that. We, for our part, will do our very best to ensure that the rhythm of deliveries is kept as prompt and as timely as possible.
You just mentioned the technical advances of this aircraft. What would be the most striking features, and why is it that you're one step ahead of the competition?
The most important new thing about this aircraft is the fact that it's built with composite materials, very largely with composite materials. That means it's a very much lighter aeroplane than the aeroplane it replaces, which in turn means that fuel consumption is much less. It takes about 20% less fuel consumption than the aeroplane it replaces. That has a positive impact on environmental issues. There's less fuel emission. Composite materials are easier to look after, easier to maintain, easier to service. Its noise footprint is very much smaller than the aeroplane it replaces. It's about 60% less noise footprint than the 767. So for all sorts of innovative and also environmental reasons, this is a huge breakthrough with new technologies.
Will this technology be applied to future aircraft models?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. The way ahead is using composite materials for structure, so you will see this replicated in future models. Absolutely.
Which will be the biggest milestone in 2013 for Boeing?
The biggest milestone in 2013? Goodness, that's hard to say. I think probably we have back orders for this aeroplane of about 850 over the next 6 or 7 years. There are currently 30-something that have been delivered to customers, so our emphasis for next year is gradually to ramp up production of this aircraft so that we can meet the extraordinarily high demand in the marketplace that it has earned.
And that was Sir Roger Bone, the CEO of Boeing UK, speaking to Monocle's Santiago Tarditi. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Burgess-Watson. Now, love or loathe fame addicts, reality TV stars and socialites such as Paris Hilton or Kim Kardashian, it's hard to deny the fact that they are both fairly astute businesswomen. Well, in addition to being a hotel empire heiress, Hilton has built up an international brand of her own with more than 40 shops across the globe. Well, like her family's hotels, her shops can be found almost anywhere in the world. And her latest focus appears to be on selling her branded handbags, accessories, fragrances and watches, to name but a few of the objects, in the Middle East. In fact, 31-year-old Hilton has just chosen the holy city of Mecca for the location of her fifth store in Saudi Arabia, sparking, not surprisingly, a considerable amount of discussion and some degree of fury in a city better known for the once-in-a-lifetime Hajj pilgrimage than for ambitious American starlets. Well, for more, I'm joined now by Saudi journalist and blogger Ahmed Al-Amran, who joins me now from Riyadh. Do you think that perhaps the fury that's been generated by the opening of this store in Mecca is all part of Hilton's marketing plan?
I don't think that Paris Hilton herself planned to open the store in Mecca. It's more likely that the company that is handling her franchise in Saudi Arabia wanted to open a store in Mecca because it's a big city with a lot of shoppers and a lot of visitors who come every year for the Hajj and throughout the year for the holy sites. I don't think it was, you know, some part of a plan to shock the people there.
But she certainly managed to generate quite a lot of discussion, such as the one we're having now, by opening a shop in a place, let's say, you might not expect at all to find a Paris Hilton shop.
I mean, of course, some people were very angry, very furious about it. Some other people thought there is nothing new in it because, you know, Mecca as a big city has all kind of shopping malls, all kind of stores, and it's not like this is the first international brand to open a store in Mecca. You already have stores for Gucci and Christian Dior and all the other international brands in Mecca. So, you know, the debate here was more about what Paris Hilton stands for, more than the fact that, you know, there is a Paris Hilton store in Mecca.
And what she stands for, if we look at her track record, there's been quite a number of scandals that have even managed to shock people in more liberal circles. So presumably there in Saudi Arabia, the opinion held of Paris Hilton is perhaps not a particularly high one.
Yeah, exactly. So the shock is not about that there is a store, especially that the store, you know, sells like handbags and shoes. The shock is more about what Paris Hilton represents and not about the store itself.
And has it generated a lot of discussion and headlines there in Saudi Arabia? 5 stores already for Paris Hilton.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, none of the previous stores actually created, you know, any discussion before. Mm. It was only the fact that this store is being opened in Mecca that, you know, caused a lot of controversy, and people were talking about it a lot on Twitter and Facebook and on social media. But, you know, as you said, it's not the first store and it's not the first international brand that's opened a branch in Saudi.
And she's not alone either, because Kim Kardashian, who's another one of these people that you read about in magazines that you pretend you don't actually buy, you sort of borrow them, or they're lying around. They belong to someone else usually. She's also been visiting the region, and she's, for example, when she went to Bahrain a few weeks ago, she generated a huge amount of excitement. Why on earth is this region of any region interested in these young ladies?
I mean, It's a big market. You know, the Gulf countries are, you know, rich countries with people who have a lot of buying power and a lot of young consumers who, you know, who want to buy these products. So it's no wonder that all international brands would be targeting the Gulf and want to sell their products there, because it is a big market with a lot of young people who are eager to identify with these international brands and want to buy in. So it's not a surprise that these brands would try to come to the region and sell their products there. The problem was, in the case of Kim Kardashian, for example, the fact that she was going to a place like Bahrain that has gone through a lot of trouble and, you know, an unrest over the past 18 months. And, you know, instead of, you know, there was a lot of attention about the visit itself and, you know, what Kim Kardashian was doing there, when the international media has ignored the fact that for a very long time now, a lot of Bahrainis have been protesting and being shot on the streets by their own government. And, you know, none of that seems to grant any attention. But when Kim Kardashian visited the place, it seems that, oh, now the world cares about Bahrain and what happens there. And that's what probably what, you know, irked a lot of people. But not everyone, because, as I remember, some Bahraini activists thought that actually any attention is good attention. And they even wanted to engage Kim Kardashian, saying, you know, why don't you come to, you know, the human rights activists in Bahrain and meet with them and talk with them about what's happening in the country, which, of course, she didn't. Mm. But, you know, for them, any attention is good attention, because the country and the uprising there has been mainly ignored by the international media.
Ahmed, of course, Kim Kardashian is an intelligent business woman as well as Paris Hilton. And her choice of clothes, for example, when she was in Bahrain, I looked at some photos just now, and she wore extremely revealing clothes with sort of stripes of flesh in amongst her. Well, it was a fairly revealing outfit, shall we say. Do you think these ladies know that what they're playing in terms of a game? Are they sort of trying to shock to the very limits that they can to generate as much interest? And do you think people are genuinely shocked, or they're pretending to be shocked themselves?
No, I mean, I can't really guess, you know, what they're thinking or what they have in mind when they do that. I think, as we said before, a lot of it has to do with the business side. You know, they're running a business and they're trying to promote their business. And, you know, if some controversy would help, then why not? And, you know, most of them are not new to controversy. They've been controversial for years. So this is not a new thing. But, you know, it's anyone's guess, you know, how does these things go? And you know, what kind of, you know, what is their what their reaction would be? Of course, there will be some, you know, there will always be someone who's offended. There will always be someone who is you know, shocked that, you know, this is happening, or look at what this person is doing. But in the end, you know, I think a lot of it is more about the business side of things and, you know, what it means to their business.
Well, I personally think your region has much more interesting stars. I'd rather have a look at a picture of Nancy Ajram or Haifa Wahebe any day. Thank you very much indeed, Ahmed Al-Omran, Saudi journalist and blogger. You're listening to Midori House. ...18:30 Greenwich Mean Time. Plenty more coming up in the next half hour.
여기 위성의 발사가 성공했습니다. 위성은 예정된 궤도에 진입했습니다.
Including what's getting this North Korean news anchor worked up into quite such a frenzy. We'll also be getting a preview of this year's Golden Globes. Also be heading to the Swiss Alps to check in with our very own Paul Noble. But first, here's David Spencer with a wrap of the world news.
Thank you. Russia has acknowledged that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government may well be defeated by opposition forces. They say government forces are losing more and more territory. Eurozone finance ministers are hailing agreement towards a banking union as a breakthrough. It means that the European Central Bank will become the zone's top banking supervisor of around 200 of the biggest institutions. South Africa's President Jacob Zuma is to face a challenge to his leadership of the ANC next week. Kgalema Motlanthe is currently President Zuma's deputy. Mr. Zuma has received most nominations, but critics say he's failed to tackle South Africa's problems. The International Air Transport Association has painted a positive picture for industry growth in 2013. Its annual review predicts a global recovery led by airlines in the United States. Its report also says 2012 is likely to be the safest year on record for its members, with one accident of any type every 5.3 million flights. That's the latest on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, David. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from London. Now, as North Korea successfully launched its three-stage rocket into space yesterday, the news was delivered to the public across the country via a report from a highly excited but unknown news anchor. On that, the only one that only the top brass in the country, likely including Kim Jong-un, actually know the name of. Well, that particular anchor is just one of several new younger faces that are gracing the screens of North Korean television. And to tell us more about this trend, our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brule, was joined by Jason Strother on the line from Seoul. And in the studio was Monocle's own minor North Korean TV star, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. More on that later. First of all, though, Tyler asked Jason if North Korean TV ever reaches the South.
You have to remember that here in South Korea, North Korean television is banned. You can't even really access it on the internet unless you know some portal sites, but they get closed down pretty quick too. So the average South Korean does not see North Korean TV except for occasions like this when, you know, during a rocket launch or the death of Kim Jong-il, when the local broadcasters will, you know, run 20-second, 30-second clips from North Korean television. I think many South Koreans kind of have a bit of a smirk when they watch North Korean television, especially, let's say, this young woman who appeared on TV yesterday. You know, she's wearing a traditional Korean gown, a hanbok, although North Korea, they don't call it that. You wouldn't see that on South Korean TV during a newscast, you know, and her over-exaggerated expressions and way of speaking, this wavering kind of talk, also is quite laughable to the average South Korean. But I think that kind of goes hand in hand. I think many South Koreans regard their northern neighbors as kind of country bumpkin cousins anyhow, so it kind of just fits that picture.
Steve, I'm wondering if this is also, I mean, we've seen these vitriolic kind of crazy bulletins out of Pyongyang before, but I'm wondering, do you think this is also, you know, given it's tied to rocket launch as well, that this is North Korea's attempt to maybe climb the YouTube stakes?
It could be as well, yes. It's their version of Gangnam Style. What's interesting is that North Korean TV has sort of changed over the last few years. It's developed. It used to be that there's still only one channel, and it's still only on for a few hours a day. But when you see the news channels now in North Korea, the news channel now in North Korea, there is a little bit more walking and talking. They're not all wearing necessarily these gowns all the time. There are a few names that many North Koreans know. They have their own sort of stars, but it's still, yes, very, very different from what you get anywhere else in the world.
Mm. Jason, just when you said that the South Koreans would look at this with perhaps a bit of a smirk, is anything, just as Steve was saying, there's so much discussion about just, you know, the modernization that we're seeing in the country, albeit very, very slow. Is that, you know, much of a discussion, though, in the Korean dailies, in op-ed pieces as well?
It's come up here before about the changing nature. I mean, I remember seeing some stills and maybe a brief video clips of, you know, some banter back and forth between North Korean anchors. You know, that's unheard of, you know, in previous years. And I think that, you know, this does kind of reflect that overall, since Kim Jong-un took power just a year ago, the government has tried to put on a more warm and friendly sort of appearance. And I think that trickles down to television broadcasts as well.
Mm. Steve, just before we go, I wanted to ask you, though, when you were in Pyongyang, you know, you talk about sort of television that's on for just a few hours a day. I mean, how much longer can this go on? Because we know when you get close to the borders, of course, you know, their mobile phones are available in the country. As we sort of, and we were talking to Ian Burrell a little bit earlier, are we close, do you think, to a media collapse there soon? Will the tide turn? And when it does turn, is it going to be one which is driven by media on the street like we've seen in so many other places?
I think when it does change, it will change very, very quickly. What was interesting, when I was there, was in 2004, and the hotel I was staying in had BBC World, and it was only that hotel, and it was only rooms that foreigners were staying in, which had access to that. No one else did. And what was interesting was, a week after I left, there was the big train crash, which killed hundreds, possibly thousands of people. We still don't know exactly how many. Now, I would have been one of the very few people in North Korea that would have known that if I was still there, because I would have seen it on BBC World. It would not have been on North Korean TV. And as you say, as more mobile phones come in, yeah, they've signed contracts with Orascom, the Egyptian network. So now more of the elite have mobile phones. Some have access to the internet, which they didn't have before. It will begin to change, but I think it's going to take a very long time. When it does happen, though, you know, you could see it just happening overnight, completely crumbling.
And that was our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, speaking with Monocle's Jason Strother in Seoul and our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this with some music and a tour of this year's Golden Globes. Three:37 in the morning in Pyongyang, 18:37 Greenwich Mean Time. Time for a song. Here's Robin with Hang With Me. And those were the dulcet tones of Robin and Hang With Me. Coming up here on Midori House, all the latest on the Golden Globes.
If you think the print industry is on its last legs, then you haven't tuned into The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly review of the best in paper, ink, varnishes, and glue. Every Saturday morning, we sit down with an informed group of editors, journalists, art directors, and photographers to flip through their favorite periodicals.
There's a huge amount of arrogance going into this, but it's got confidence and pride, and that makes for a fantastic end result.
It's a matter of pride to be involved in certain magazines. It's not about the reach and numbers, it's about the reach and quality.
Matte or glossy, saddle stitched or perfect bound, The Stack is an hour of opinions, predictions, and proclamations about all the titles we hoard, archive, and savor.
There is a real difference, and the difference will become more sharply edged as time goes on.
The biggest breakfast buffet of magazines and newspapers is served up every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and a passionate mix of print aficionados.
I think it's real when it's ink. You can take it home and it doesn't flicker.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18:43. It's 10:43 in the morning in Los Angeles. Now, the Golden Globes, recognising achievements in film and television, are considered by many movie buffs to be a significant precursor to the slightly more glamorous Academy Awards. And with 1 month to go before the winners are announced, this year's contenders were unveiled in a suitably star-studded event in the small hours of this Thursday morning. Well, a little earlier on, I caught up with Monocle's regular film expert, Karen Kritsanovich, to get her take on this year's lineup of movies. We started with the one that's on every critic's lips this year, Lincoln.
There's a good reason why everybody's excited about Lincoln. Number one, it's a terrific performance from Daniel Day-Lewis. He's finally back. And, you know, he's very, very choosy about what he chooses to play. And it's, even though it's a very, very long film, it is morally uplifting. It's got a very positive feel to it. It's got a lot of other famous supporting actors, and it's got some wonderful cameo turns by people that we recognize. And it tells an uplifting story of a time when America made an important decision. And I think particularly after an election, it was very important to have it released then. In fact, Spielberg waited to have it released after the election. So I think the timing has a lot to do with it. But Spielberg likes to make films that are they have import, which is a good thing.
Mm. Well, let's take a listen now, actually, to a clip from that very film, Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln has asked us to work with him to accomplish the death of slavery.
No one's ever been loved so much by the people. Don't waste that power.
This fight is for the United States of America.
Wow, I can see why you're saying uplifting. Haven't seen it, but it sounds like one of those films that is definitely going to make you leave the cinema feeling rather like you've been on a journey.
Well, he's an honest politician. it's unusual.
Back in the day.
Yes, of course. And it makes you want to look at your pennies and $5 bills a lot differently, I'll tell you that.
Who's Lincoln going to be up against in particular in that category?
Well, speaking from a position of entertainment rather than criticizing things, Argo is tremendously entertaining, and that has the equal number of nominations, Golden Globe nominations. This is Ben Affleck's third feature, and it is a history lesson and an entertainment, a bit of entertainment all rolled into one. It's basically the story of the Iran hostage crisis in 1980, where six, I believe, hostages were holed up in the Canadian embassy, and how they get them out. And how they get them out is by concocting just a ridiculous science fiction film that has to be filmed in Iran.
Mm. So I loved that, actually. I really
enjoyed
it. Did
you see
it? Yeah, I went to see it, and I thought it was really well made as well.
Yes.
And given the attention to detail of capturing late 70s, early 80s Iran at that time of just so much tension in the air and in Tehran, it was really brilliantly done in my book.
Yeah, well, the production design was terrific. I mean, the hair. I've been talking a lot to wardrobe and makeup people, and they're working on films. And, you know, they tell the story just as much as a scriptwriter does. Mm. And they got the period look just perfect. And that was a terrifying time. We think, it's a funny story. Also, the ending of Argo, I was clawing another critic right next to me. It's like, being completely unprofessional.
Seriously sweating palms.
It was amazing. Yeah.
Were they going to get off the ground or not?
Exactly.
Very good film indeed. And as you say, the fashion of the era totally captured accurately. And actually, I think it's come back a lot of
the
it as
harvest
well.
And avocado.
Quite a lot of that stuff is back. So
it
was actually looking pretty good rather than offensive. What else was particularly catching your eye?
Well, I think, I'm really quite happy with what the Golden Globes came up with for nominations. They did surprise a lot of people by bringing up salmon fishing in the Yemen, which is which is Emily Blunt and Ewan McGregor in a story of trying to take salmon fishing to the Yemen. I mean, obviously, the title describes it. It was a film that kind of came and went. It was beautifully done, actually a really nice script and lovely production values. For some reason, it didn't take off. But I actually thought that they had a bit of chemistry going on there. And I think Beasts of the Southern Wild, which everybody's touting as an Oscar film, has been completely shut out here. But we have to remember that the Golden Globe nominations are not the AMPAS nominations. They're not Oscars. These are the foreign press voting in America. So it's a different slant.
They're called a really important sort of barometer for the Oscars. But do you think that's a little bit overdone?
They used to think that. They don't think that much anymore because there's been too many aberrations technically. And also there's very little a crossover, if any. But I also think that the slant here, this is trying to bring an international look at more of a domestic industry, if that makes any sense. America has a tendency to see films in a very different way. For example, a film that doesn't do well in America will do really well in Europe or in Asia or South America or wherever, and vice versa. So we're trying to bring a little bit more of the world into Hollywood.
And that seems to have happened because quite a lot of British directors up for nominations, quite a lot of French names on the list, the actors and actresses and so on. That's quite striking, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is, because Americans don't like to read subtitles. Like Marion Cotillard for Rust and Bone has been nominated, and I think she's going to be very strong for the Critics' Circle in London here as well. We've also got an overlooked performance by Rachel Weisz in The Deep Blue Sea, which she was amazing in. And another film, which I cried when I saw, not scared to admit it, Naomi Watts in The Impossible, which is the story of the tsunami, which is incredibly moving and beautifully done. And I think that I'm actually very, very pleased with the way the Golden Globes have kind of shaped up. There's nothing here that really makes me flare my nostrils and get mad, which is unlike most years.
And the best foreign language categories.
Very strong.
Fantastic films in
very,
there.
Very, very strong. Also the best animated ones as well. But the foreign ones, Amour is very strong.
Yeah.
And they think will probably, is definitely going to take some gongs this year. A Royal Affair is something, if you haven't seen,
it's got
Mads Mikkelsen.
Loved it.
It's astonishing.
It's brilliant. It's definitely one of my best films of 2012.
It really sticks in my mind. And for it to be a foreign film in a language that I don't know, I mean, granted, I'm a Mads Mikkelsen fan anyway, but the story of this doctor that falls in love with the queen, basically.
Didn't know that story myself.
No, beforehand. Me neither.
She was a British queen as well.
Mm-hmm. She was indeed, and very, very unhappy as well. The Untouchables, Contiki. I mean, actually, all of the films here in Rust and Bone in the foreign language film department are very, very strong, very good. I mean, and you look here and you don't see anything that really jangles. They all deserve. I think that was the one thing about this list. The Golden Globes this year, every single film that's nominated is worthy of the nomination.
In one word, your film for 2012, what is it going to be? You're covering your face. You clearly don't want to answer this question.
I'm happy to answer it. I have to say, for just a good bit of entertainment where you actually learn something and you don't get clobbered over the head, I'd have to say it's Argo.
And that was Monocle's regular film expert, Karen Kritsanovich, there with her recommendations and her take on this year's Golden Globes. We're going to be heading to Switzerland in just a moment. To help us get there, though, is the Swiss band Boy with Oh Boy.
She's so easy to fall for, but boy, she's so hard to hold. She looks at you like something important to say.
And that was the Swiss band Boy with Oh Boy. And we're going to stay on that Swiss note because in less than 2 weeks' time, when you're unwrapping your Christmas presents and tucking into some goose and a couple of bottles of good red wine as well. Monocle 24 will be broadcasting live from the picture postcard Alpine Ski Resort of St. Moritz, or San Moritz, depending on how you pronounce it. And joining us now is Monocle's Paul Noble, who's prepping the stage for the arrival of our producers, guests, and illustrious mascot, Mono-chan. Hello, Paul. You've just arrived, have you?
I have, Tom. Good evening. We are in the very centre of St. Moritz, outside the Hotel Hauser, where we'll be broadcasting from. I'll set the scene. It's very cold. It's around minus 15. We're standing here wrapped in several layers of clothing, and certainly an après-ski scene going on in the background. There's lots of hot cider going around and some music on the stereo. And it's absolutely beautiful here. As you imagine, everything, the journey was very smooth, very scenic 4-hour train ride from Zurich through as many Christmas trees as you could ever see. Turn up at the hotel, everything works beautifully. All the preparations have been made for the broadcast. And it seems like everyone here is quite excited about our week of shows coming from just outside the hotel.
You've painted a beautiful scene and made me nostalgic for the time I visited that ski resort, I suppose when I was a very, very little boy, perhaps 5 or 6 years old. Now, you were mentioning the programming there that's coming to us from St. Moritz. Tell us a little bit about what's on the agenda.
Well, we've got the briefing, and Midori House will be coming from here from, I believe, the 26th onwards for a week. Tyler's going to be out here, Andrew Tuck will be here, Sophie Grove and Marcus Hippie will all be here, and there'll be two live shows a day. We're also producing a special one-off episode of The Review from here. So there'll be a lot of local flavour. We'll certainly be checking in with chefs. And a lot of the people who come and will spend their winters in St. Moritz, some of whom you'll know because they've been on Monocle before, and some of whom we're just going to track down and talk to them about what they're doing in this fantastic and very high-up alpine resort.
That's right, as you mentioned there. So from the 26th of December through to the 1st of January, shows coming to you there from St. Moritz, including The Review, as you just mentioned there, Saturday the 29th of December, 1300 local time, which is, of course, 1300, which is 12 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. So some skiers there, you mentioned, on the slopes already. They were chancing it when they bought their tickets, because sometimes there isn't any snow in this time of year.
Yeah, I think these were the ones who took a punt and came out a bit early, but it's certainly, there's plenty of snow here, and the ski season has fully kicked off. You can see the hotel here is fully built for skiers. It's got very easy access for those in ski boots and so on. So yeah, I mean, I certainly, Jack Phillips, my colleague, and I were looking enviously at these guys with their snowboards and skis, but we're just in and out, just setting it all up for the big push on the 26th.
Well, I hope you've packed some very warm clothes. Thank you very much indeed, Monocle 24 producer Paul Noble there in St. Moritz. I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today on Midori House. Today, our producer was Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Sam Impey. Next up on Monocle 24 is The Urbanist, where this week Andrew Tuck is looking at how urban life has changed, including a conversation about what Toronto's modernist legacy has to do with the city today.
Between 1950 and 1980, for every single family home built in the suburbs in Toronto, 2 apartment units were built. So there was far more high-rise apartments built on a per-unit basis than single-family homes, which makes us a very different urban region than most regions in North America.
All that coming up, and in 3 hours' time, 2200 hours London time, I'll be here with Tighe Enright for the Monocle Daily. Tyler Brulé back with Midori House same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.